Hey, it's Bob, and it's the end of the year when we annually ask for your support. And it's also the beginning of a new era when I think we need to support one another for our part with relentless questioning of authority and our brand of illuminating what isn't necessarily in plain view. It is really easy to donate. Just go to onthemedia.org/donate. Or text the letters OTM to the number 69866. 69866. Thank you, listeners. Seriously, we cannot do this without you. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Look, there's not a whole lot of comfort in the show coming up. We're just trying to do what we do, which is drill down on the stuff we think is important. But frankly, recent events have made us less confident in our gut in deciding what to cover, less confident in our heads, too. We find ourselves in the grip of centrifugal forces. One is magical thinking, the other, failure of the imagination. Let me explain. Last summer, we spoke to journalist Masha Gessen, whose perspective on American politics is shaped by her Russian roots. She said our media suffered from a disabling failure of the imagination when it came to Donald Trump.
We need to start imagining what happens if he becomes president. Now, the American system doesn't actually give the chief executive a lot of power. There's an intricate system of checks and balances that will force him to mobilize things through rhetoric. And that basically means, I think, that we have to start imagining witch hunts. We have to start imagining kind of wars at home. We have to start imagining what kind of groups he's going to start blaming for all his problems and all our problems, whether real or imaginary.
So your advice to the news consumer?
My advice to the news consumer is imagine the worst.
But is it better to use imagination or to apply judgment based on research and experience when choosing what to cover? For instance, when we spoke to the New York Times' very smart David Leonhardt back in 2015, he was editing the paper's data-driven blog called The Upshot, where he'd just written that it was the duty of his site to point out when a candidate just isn't going to win.
It lets you in the press cover the real battle that's going on among Walker and Bush and Rubio and others to get the nomination.
He thought it was, frankly, a disservice to readers to waste their time on the fun and games afforded by a crowded field of nominees. Much better to come clean and lay out what the available data and past history made manifestly clear.
And I think that saying that to readers, without going so far as to saying there is no scenario under any situation, no matter what, in which the nominee will be someone other than Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, and Marco Rubio, is a way to level with readers and to be honest with them about what we know and what we don't know.
So, we have 4 years to atone for knowing. We are now obliged to imagine. And that brings me to the other force swinging us around like a tetherball, magical thinking, by which I mean believing in things more strongly than either evidence or experience justifies.
Realistic or not, some protesters across the nation are hanging their hopes on what many would say is a pipe dream, that members of the Electoral College will block Donald Trump's election when they vote on December 19th.
Throughout history, the faithless electors have never changed an election's results.
They could, in fact, starve Trump of an outright victory and kick the election to the House of Representatives. But even then, blue-eyed noodler Paul Ryan and the boys wouldn't further indulge this existential crisis. They would give in to DT. While Hillary sinks into a deeper depression as potential power escapes her icy grasp, there are still basement-bound propeller heads dreaming up fantastical ways she could still be their rocket queen.
It was when one of our producers suggested covering the media rumblings over the potential for an Electoral College revolt that sent us gyrating between those two centrifugal poles. We decided not to cover it. It was magical thinking. We already had a full plate of reality. But watching Mr. Trump assemble his cabinet, installing, as Bob put it, a fox in every henhouse, reality can really tell. attacks your imagination. On December 1st, the government vastly expanded its powers to hack into our computers and smartphones. You likely didn't hear about it because the amendments to Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure were deemed merely procedural, requiring neither a debate nor even a vote, despite the warnings of Senator Ron Wyden.
At midnight tonight, this Senate will make one of the biggest mistakes in surveillance policy in years and years.
The changes to Rule 41 allow judges to grant electronic search warrants for computers and other devices with unknown locations. It also allows bulk search warrants, which means one judge can permit the search of potentially millions of devices, all remotely. The Justice Department says the changes were prompted by a recent investigation in which the FBI used malware to break into computers and devices that visited a child porn website known as Playpen. Some judges threw out the evidence the FBI obtained because they found the warrant invalid. Rainey Reitman is director of activism at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has criticized the Rule 41 changes.
Historically, say you're with the FBI, you're supposed to go to the district where a computer is located in order to get your search warrant for that computer. But if you don't know where the computer is located, that raises a series of questions. In the Playpen cases, the courts were really struggling to understand how to deal with a single magistrate judge authorizing hundreds of searches on hundreds of computers with a single search warrant. And the courts have been all over the place on this. Some courts are throwing it out, saying, well, this wasn't a valid search warrant. And others saying, oh, I'm not even sure you needed a search warrant. Maybe you don't have a right to privacy on your home computer. This, to me, seemed like a great opportunity for Congress to say, there's confusion about the law on this issue. We're going to hold hearings, we're going to speak to experts, and we're going to create some reasonable rules of the road for when the FBI can hack into computers. And unfortunately, that didn't happen.
But instead, Congress simply allowed the Justice Department to implement these changes without discussion, and these changes remove those jurisdictional limitations. So you could go to just one judge and get a warrant to access countless computers, maybe even a million.
Exactly. The government can really cherry-pick any judge they want. And we've seen instances of the government choosing to take its investigations to the most prosecution-friendly judge that they could find. We saw a case in Riverside where the DEA found a judge who was willing to sign off on wiretap orders, and they took wiretap orders from all across the country to him, 600 wiretap orders coming from a single Riverside judge. And I think what will happen with the changes to Rule 41 is the government will quickly be able to figure out, is there perhaps a technically naive or a prosecution-friendly judge somewhere in this country, and can we just put all of our search warrant applications in front of that judge?
There's a related change in Rule 41, which allows the government to hack our devices in order to at least theoretically fix them.
The government wants the ability to not only investigate botnets, you know, when your computer has been infected with malware and it's now part of this system that could send out viruses or spam or be used to create a zombie army of computers, and you might not know. So, gosh, of course that's a big deal, and the FBI is saying, well, we want to be able to do something about it. But in their efforts to clean up these botnets, I mean, they could, for example, deploy what they think is a fix that could actually do serious harm to your computer. Or in their process, they may access information that's quite private. So that doesn't mean that we don't want the government ever involved in cleaning up botnets. It means we really want Congress to weigh in on this issue. But instead of having this conversation and coming up with the right solution, we went with a default solution, which is let's just let more people issue these search warrants.
Because it was about child porn. That's an area with a big red box around it. What's to discuss?
We have to remember, these tools will not simply be used to go after child pornographers. They'll be able to use it for all sorts of different types of investigations, not just the ones that people may find most heinous.
Now, privacy advocates like your organization were already concerned about Rule 41 and other expansions of surveillance powers under the Obama administration, which doesn't, in your view, have a particularly good record on this. What specific expansions are you and EFF watching?
A government-mandated backdoor into encryption technology. This is a fight that we've had on and off for years, and we saw a huge battle over it within an investigation of the San Bernardino iPhone.
This was the iPhone of people who committed mass murder in San Bernardino.
Right. The FBI wanted to have Apple defeat its own security protocols in order to gain access to information on the phone. And Apple, they didn't want to set a precedent where you would have tech companies actually spending resources building custom tools for the government to break security features.
So mandated crypto backdoors, that's number one you're worried about. Anything else?
What am I not worried about? So I'm also quite concerned at Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It's the section of law that the government argues gives them the right to collect data in bulk, who you're emailing, what web pages you're accessing, basically to tap into the backbone of the internet and conduct searches. And that section was so controversial that it would automatically sunset every few years.
And you're concerned that there may be a move in the next administration to get rid of the sunset provision so you can never revisit it.
Well, my big concern first is that the powerful reforms that we had been expecting in the coming year, because this will be the first sunset since the Snowden revelations, that those are not only put into jeopardy, but that even the sunset itself could be put into jeopardy. Mm-hmm. I hate to even say it because these are some of my nightmares, and I hope by saying it, I'm not making it happen.
But you do say there is one thing that President Obama could do. It's something he's promised from the beginning, not often delivered on, and that is transparency.
Right. And it's something that can't be easily undone because once you have disclosed something and brought public light to it, the information is out there for the world. One of the things that is particularly challenging about the NSA is not only are many of their programs shrouded in secrecy, but what they've told a court and what their justifications are will literally be held in secret. We have this really phenomenal process where we use the court systems to refine and examine laws passed by Congress and interpret them. When the NSA or the FBI is able to engage in surveillance and no one ever knows about it and they never have to justify it, that's when they're able to really run roughshod over civil liberties. But when they know that someone will ask them questions and that it could result in a front page story on the New York Times or they could be called up in front of Congress to defend themselves, when they know that their activities are going to be made public, that potential of transparency can have a major chilling effect on surveillance abuses. It's an incredibly powerful tool.
Rainey, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
Rainey Reitman is the director of activism at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The fight for a vote, or at least a delay on implementing Rule 41, was led by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. He failed. Senator Wyden, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So last week, you said the Senate was about to, quote, make one of the biggest mistakes in surveillance policy in years and years.
When the Justice Department claimed that this was just a modest kind of change, kind of housekeeping, that, in my view, was an absurd argument. Here you have an effort that authorizes mass government hacking without any congressional input whatsoever.
The government says that to a certain degree, it wants to come into computers that have already been hacked, maybe linked up to botnets, which are vast networks of computers infected by malware. For that reason, the government wants the chance to come in and fix the computer that has been enlisted unbeknownst to its owner. The government is saying it's here to help.
The fact is, the potential for collateral damage is really extraordinary. Let's remember, the government won't just be hacking your cell phone or desktop.
it might need to hack into traffic lights, security cameras, based on everything we have learned from independent cyber experts, there's a real chance that the hacked devices will be damaged or broken.
Now, for months, you and a handful of other senators tried to get even a hearing on this issue. Why do you think most of your colleagues refused to touch it?
Given the last few months, there was an awful lot on the congressional plate, and one observer said the Justice Department was trying to go forward under the cover of dullness. And it is sort of Senate 101 that you don't just let the government wave their arms around in the air and give themselves new powers under the Fourth Amendment without a single hearing and without senators asking some questions. When there are problems with this, and they're going to be, Americans are going to come to their legislators and say, what were you thinking about? Were you really too busy to have even one hearing when you're talking about one judge, one warrant, authorizing the hacking of possibly millions of devices, cell phones, and tablets?
What do you anticipate these complaints from the public ultimately will be? Will it be, hey, the government broke my computer remotely? Or the government looked at my medical record and I didn't want them to? Or
I think both of those you touched on very real concerns that citizens are likely to have.
But the argument for changing Rule 41 was that it was outdated, that the federal government's limits on hacking were preventing it from pursuing legitimate criminal investigations.
We know technology is evolving. And by the way, I wrote the section of the USA Freedom Act that says when the government has an emergency, the government can move immediately to protect the public and get the warrant and then come back and settle up later. So I've made it clear that I am very interested in both security and liberty. I just think the two are not mutually exclusive.
Let's consider the context of these changes. They come from the fact that an investigation into child pornography was hamstrung.
I think it is possible to be very tough on practices that we consider god-awful without throwing the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution in the trash can. And that is our job. There are two parts to this. Hidden location, we can fix. Botnecks, you need to approach in a different way.
So you would be okay with extending the jurisdiction of a single court to many thousands or even millions of computers in one circumstance, but not to automatically go into any computer that happens to have been in a system that had been hacked?
Yeah, I think this is a different day. We're talking about computers. We're not talking about kicking open a person's door, but there still needs to be important due process protections.
You have been able to walk across the aisle to find Republican allies on privacy and surveillance issues before, if not this one. It's kind of a bipartisan issue. What do you think your prospects are for working with a Republican Senate and House in the Donald Trump administration?
You characterize it right. We have bipartisan support. But here's my take on the new administration. The president-elect, when asked about hacking his political opponents, said, I wish I had that power. You've got FBI Director Comey publicly talking about ongoing investigations, going against decades of precedents, and FBI agents extensively leaking information about those investigations. There's a real possibility of the FBI hacking into a victim's computer after they've been attacked, not telling them about it until afterward, if at all. Under this new rule, they don't have to do that. They just have to make what they call a reasonable effort. So yes, Americans should be concerned about giving the government more authority to hack thousands of devices with one warrant.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
To be continued.
Yeah, absolutely. Senator Ron Wyden is a Democrat and member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence.
Coming up, if you can't beat them, sue them. Potential legal woes for the media in a Trump presidency.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. During his campaign, now President-elect Trump made this threat to the media.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws.
As law is made by legislators and the courts, not the president, it was a typically bombastic and mainly empty threat, but not to be altogether dismissed. In recent years, libel laws have been weaponized by billionaires who combine their deep pockets with a public contempt for the press to exploit weaknesses in First Amendment protections. And fighting those cases can be ruinously expensive. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine who published a piece called Billionaires Versus the Press in the Era of Trump. Emily, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Three elements here. There's the economic chaos in media, there's the rise of proxy litigants, and there's Trump. So let's start with him. It's kind of an odd thing to promise to change libel law because it's as settled as any settled law is in this country, no?
Yes. In 1964, we have this famous revered case called New York Times versus Sullivan. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the New York Times. At issue in the case was an advertisement that had been paid for by a large group of civil rights supporters. It had some small errors in it. And the person who sued, who was a city commissioner in the town of Montgomery, Alabama, said that this ad reflected badly on him. And at the time, the usual standard was that if the statement being sued over was false, the plaintiff won. This ad was false in that it had these small mistakes in it. The Supreme Court really raised the bar for plaintiffs to win in a libel suit in its decision in this case, creating what we know as the actual malice standard. The plaintiff has to show not just that a statement is false, but also that it was made with knowing or reckless disregard for the truth. It's hard to show that. And so traditionally, the press has really been protected by that high bar. And Donald Trump as president doesn't have any direct power to change that.
So in other words, a public figure like a president has to show that the news organization either failed entirely to vet the truth of the statement in question or knew that it was a lie to begin with. The only person I can think of in public life who has talked about political figures in a way that could wind up in a libel suit is Donald Trump.
That's right. And actually, a very well-known First Amendment lawyer named Floyd Abrams, who's usually not on the side of bringing a libel suit, he recently raised the possibility of media figures suing Donald Trump for calling them dishonest or in other ways trying to shred their credibility.
In the last year or so, notably in the libel case against Gawker, a billionaire, Peter Thiel, essentially bankrolled the entire case. And it was not an isolated incident. What happens to libel law in this country when third parties are willing to fund even dead-on-arrival cases in order to punish some publisher defendant?
Well, that's a really good question. And what we saw with Peter Thiel was this essentially a secret campaign where he was funding a lawyer named Charles Harder to bring some unknown number of suits against Gawker. The case that happened to be the winning ticket for an enormous jury verdict that caused Gawker to go bankrupt was a privacy case on behalf of Hulk Hogan. Gawker had published a brief clip from a sex tape of Hogan. But there were a number of suits that were out there as kind of possibilities, almost as if Thiel was, you know, spinning the roulette wheel until he hit on a winner. And this idea of using the law as a weapon to go after a publication and to try to kill it, that's a pretty new phenomenon. It's a kind of aggressive weaponizing of litigation.
And it's almost not a question of whether the litigation is successful. It's the very fact of being sued that is so expensive for publications that even if they ultimately prevail, they're bankrupt. What protection do news organizations have against this kind of suit whose goal is merely to inflict the economic punishment of litigation?
I'm glad you brought that up because it's quite hard as a plaintiff suing the press to win a libel suit. But it's not hard to get into court. And once you get into court, you invoke all of legal process, discovery, turning over documents, making people sit for depositions. All of that can be expensive and time-consuming and painful for writers and editors to deal with. There are 28 states that have what are called anti-slap laws on the books. And these are designed to throw out quickly frivolous lawsuits, but it's not that hard to pick a state that does not have an anti-slap law on the books. The suit against Gawker was in Florida, and there is no anti-slap there. The small magazine Mother Jones faced a libel suit from another billionaire that was in Idaho, another place where there's no anti-slap protection on the books.
Are there any prospects for national anti-slap legislation? The GOP has shown quite an affinity for the First Amendment over the years. Could there be a national standard so that someone like Peter Thiel can't go jurisdiction shopping in order to file such a suit?
Sure, there could. But I would argue that the Republican or conservative affinity for the First Amendment is pretty selective. So they like it, for example, in Citizens United when it's allowing for much more money to flow into elections. The idea that they're going to make sure to pass a federal law to prevent billionaires from suing the press, that seems quite unlikely to me. One thing that would really help publishers in these kinds of suits would be damages caps. So, for example, in the United Kingdom, it's much easier to win a libel suit. In America, we usually think of the United States law as superior for this reason. But there's an unofficial cap on damages in the UK of £250,000. And that means that you can't sue to try to take down and bankrupt a publication. You can sue to defend your reputation and to get some money, which is, you know, usually what we think of the purpose of litigation.
I don't want to turn this into an us and them issue, but if Trump has whipped up a frenzy among his conservative supporters about the press, and he's done this largely through the right-wing media, which are often the vectors for some of the ugliest smears, mainly against politicians. I wonder if what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Are there any liberal billionaires out there scouring the Breitbarts of the world looking to see if they can pull a Thiel?
It's possible that it's out there. I think, though, it just seems like a misuse of the courts. Libel law is about defending one's reputation. It shouldn't be about trying to attack a publication because you don't like what it's saying. And I would argue that right now we need an aggressive press more than ever. We have a president coming into office who doesn't respect the norms and conventions of traditional coverage. We have no idea whether he's going to hold press conferences. He puts out lies on Twitter or in interviews that become a kind of virus in the public discourse. All of those challenges, I don't think the press has really figured out how to deal with. But what we need is a press that is not cowed and is not supine and is giving a clear accounting of this coming presidency.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times and the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at Yale Law School. Rolling Stone's now infamous 2014 article, A Rape on Campus, portrayed gruesome details of an alleged gang rape of a University of Virginia freshman and the university's supposed institutional indifference to the victim. Within weeks of its publication, reporting from the Washington Post and others found major gaps in Rolling Stone's reporting, and it turned out that much of the story had been fabricated by the article's main source. The UVA administrator, whom the story characterized as turning a blind eye to rape, sued for defamation and was awarded $3 million. The jury was particularly offended that Rolling Stone kept the original story online, albeit with an apologetic disclaimer about its errors. Now, the ethos of online publishing encourages transparency in updates and frowns on attempts to erase errors altogether. So the magazine is asking a judge to overturn the jury's decision. Taylor Reese Shapiro is an education reporter for The Washington Post. He's been on the story from the very beginning. Taylor, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
So Rolling Stone is asking for the judge to vacate the $3 million damages. It is not claiming that its story was solid reporting.
That's correct. In fact, during the trial, a lot of the defense coming from the lawyers representing Rolling Stone essentially said, we made a tremendous mistake. This has damaged our reputation. However, we never intended to defame the plaintiff in the case, the UVA administrator, Nicola Romo.
And then, adding insult to injury, never pulled the original offending story from its website. What did it do instead exactly?
They did not alter the story whatsoever, other than to add this disclaimer, essentially saying that there are significant flaws in this article that you're going to read below this, and we apologize for it, and we no longer have faith in the main source of our article, this young woman, Jackie. What I think is the standard operating procedure for most publications now in the digital age, and I can mainly speak from my experience at the Washington Post, is when you make a mistake, you immediately correct it in some way. Generally, there's going to be language that you have updated or fixed an error in the story. On top of that, generally, you'll repeat whatever the error was, and then you'll add what you have corrected. So if you said a person quoted in this story was named Robert Smith, and in fact, he's actually named Richard Smith, you would correct the error within the body of the story. But not to confuse people, you would at least admit the original mistake that you had. Rolling Stone admitted they had a mistake, but they did not revise the piece. They also didn't add any strike-through language or note in any significant way with annotations or something saying that this part of the story we can no longer believe because, you know, we no longer trust our source. All they did was put up the disclaimer.
It was the fact that the uncorrected story remained alive online that incensed the jury. Why not, in a case like this, pull it offline altogether?
I think the correct move would have been absolutely to just retract the entire story from the website. Maybe a little bit of hubris got in the way. Rolling Stone had been extremely defiant as doubts began to arise. They didn't know exactly how bad it was.
Now, Rolling Stone's lawyers, in asking for the award to be vacated, say, no, 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 you're getting this wrong, jury. If you think that you're going to encourage publishers to be more transparent in their correcting of errors, this is not the way to go about it. It's actually going to have the opposite effect. What's the basis of that claim?
They argue that had they done nothing, had they not at least admitted the mistake in writing on the account that remained online, that there would be no cause for the jury to award any defamation damages. The argument being that since they hadn't admitted it, they wouldn't have had the prior knowledge basis in the defamation law to prove that they knew the mistake was wrong but published it anyway. In trying to do good in their eyes, they said, by publishing this disclaimer onto the story, they also, on the other hand, admitted a mistake, knew the information within it was false, and published it anyway, which is exactly the standard you have to meet for a limited public figure, as Nicola Romo was deemed by the judge. That's the very fine point of why Rolling Stone actually was found accountable for defamation.
Now, in tort law, there's such thing as a statute of limitations, and that means that once 2 years expires, you've lost your chance to seek remedy in the courts. But if this decision stands, it means every publisher is liable essentially in perpetuity, because what's online never really fully goes away, for every mistake it has ever made if it can't prove that it was an honest error. If this decision is left standing, does this create a legal jeopardy for publishers in the digital age that is just another nail in the coffin of press freedom?
It's just one more risk news organizations will have to mitigate as they consider how they move forward in the future. Suppose a figure comes back into the news after a long time and you pull up something from the archives in the 1970s from the newspaper and you decide, hey, you know, why don't we put this online? It's relevant to then. It's relevant to now. Suppose there had been an error hidden in that old print story and you republish it on your website. You're bringing it back into the public realm. You're now liable as a news organization for possible defamation suits.
The judge's decision in this case could well have an effect on how all publishers handle corrections from this point forward, it's absolutely going to have an impact on Rolling Stone in the near future because there's a potentially much more ruinous court case yet ahead.
That's right, and that involves the fraternity Phi Kappa Psi, which was not only depicted in words in the articles being the center of this ritualistic sex assault behavior, but the opening spread very clearly depicted the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity house with its Greek letters out front. And I think that those kinds of details will make it almost unavoidable for Rolling Stone to face up to the fact that they published information that turned out to be totally false. There was no place where the fraternity was described in any ways as positive. It was only depicted in this sort of very evil manner. And I don't think that it'll ruin the magazine itself. They're very popular. They're on newsstands everywhere. Subscriptions are doing very well, they tell me. But this will cost them a pretty penny for sure.
Taylor, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Taylor Reese Shapiro is an education reporter for The Washington Post.
Coming up, hey, Bobby, you want to share a pizza?
I sure would. Can we get it with extra pepperoni?
It sounds dirtier in email. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend, a North Carolina man showed up at Comet Ping Pong, a Washington, D.C. pizza shop, armed with an AR-15.
Edgar Welch drove from his home in North Carolina, apparently to investigate an online conspiracy theory known as Pizzagate.
Pizzagate. The gate connoting scandal, and the pizza, as Edgar Welch discovered to his surprise, connoting pizza. As he told the New York Times, quote, the intel on this wasn't 100%, which is strange because over the past few months, some of the nation's leading crackpots have used subreddits, 4chan, YouTube, and other dark corners of the web to unequivocally implicate Hillary Clinton and various Washington elites in a literal underground pedophilia market in the basement of Comet Ping Pong. And did I mention Satan?
I'm not excited to confirm this, but my research is correct. There is a satanic pedophile cult operating in D.C. and pretty much under most of our noses up until the WikiLeaks emails came out.
That's from so-called citizen journalist David Seaman, who, like other sleuths, exposed the grand conspiracy with clues from the hacked John Podesta emails made public by WikiLeaks, ambiguous contemporary art, ancient passageways beneath Connecticut Avenue, and, dare I say it, Italian food. The pizza shop owner was a fundraiser for Clinton. Come on, do the math. Like many conspiracy theories, it involved cherry-picking unrelated facts and not facts to construct a narrative supporting a pre-existing worldview. But don't worry, the notion that Hillary Clinton was linked to serial sex crimes was embraced only by tens of thousands of web denizens and Donald Trump's national security advisor. If ever there were a case for Snopes.com, the rumor verification website, this was it. The focus of the suspicion, says Snopes content manager Kim LaCapria, is Clinton's erstwhile campaign chairman, John Podesta.
One of the threads was that John Podesta and his brother were in Portugal at the time that Madeleine McCann was abducted, and that became a big thread in the Pizzagate conspiracy.
This is the young English child who, a decade ago, went missing while her parents were out to dinner in a Portuguese resort.
Yes, and I've had people send me the drawings that people do of potential suspects. They've said, like, oh, this is obviously John Podesta. How can you not see it? So that type of thing gets pretty expansive.
Yeah, it's just hard for me to understand how even the most disordered mind would make the leap between a pizza shop whose owner is a Hillary Clinton supporter to a pedophilia ring, which supposedly involves a host of D.C. elites, including apparently the president himself.
Obama has been photographed there playing ping pong with the boy.
Once you start slipping down this slope of believing, then everything looks like a part of it. You may see a picture of President Obama playing ping pong with a child and think that it's a photo opportunity. But if somebody's mired in this way of thinking, or they've been spending a lot of time reading about it, they may see that and see something completely else as like a Rorschach type thing.
You mentioned that because the accusation in Pizzagate was so wild, it was actually hard to categorically disprove it. And you originally characterized your assessment as unproven. You have since switched to false. How did you get from unproven to false?
You know, the scope of the claims being made, it would involve the Clinton campaign, the whole network of Podesta and his campaign people, all these businesses in the area of the pizzeria. The police would have to be keeping quiet about it. The families of the children affected would have to be keeping quiet. There was just no way that all of these people involved wouldn't produce a shred of evidence, even accidentally, that there was some kind of cover-up going on. You know, people can't just disappear into a vast conspiracy without somebody noticing. You know, one person would be extraordinary. Dozens of people would be even more extraordinary, and there wasn't any evidence. You know, people presented what they believed constituted evidence. I got a lot of pictures of shirtless men tweeted to me, you know, like, oh, well, don't you see what's going on here? I'm like, looks like two guys who were at a club. I don't think there's anything really compelling about that as evidence, but that would be what we saw presented, or artwork that people thought was strange, which didn't look very strange. It just like artwork. So there was absolutely no evidence that we could find whatsoever. And, you know, people always think that we have an interest in proving things false. But if we could prove this true, it would be way better for the site. It would be considered some kind of journalistic coup to unravel this conspiracy. So we didn't have any specific interest in marking it false. It just came down to the fact we didn't have any evidence to prove that there was even a possibility that any part of it could be true.
Uh-huh. Well, that's because you focused on the pizza. Did it occur to you? Did it even occur to you to look at the Stromboli?
No, I have to say, we did not take notice of the Stromboli or other menu items.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. Kim, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Kim LaCapria is content manager at Snopes.com.
The specifics of the Pizzagate conspiracy theory bubbling up through Twitter and 4chan seem very au courant. But the central myth that members of a reviled group partake in child sex abuse has a long history. Richard Beck is author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s. He described in Slate this week how Pizzagate resonates with pedophilia scares in decades past.
The thing that reminded me of the 1980s was the idea that it was this vast conspiracy, international in scope. I mean, there was a case in the 1980s in Los Angeles involving a place called the McMartin Preschool. The teachers there were thought to have abused something like 400 children who attended the school. They had detectives and FBI agents looking around the country for where they may have hidden away child pornography the teachers were suspected of making, you know, for sale on the international market. McMartin wound up being one of, if not the longest and most expensive criminal trials in American history. The investigation started in 1983, and the trial didn't end for good until 1990 or 1991.
People went to jail?
At the end of McMartin, there were no convictions, although the primary defendant spent 5 years in jail while the trial was going on because the judge refused to grant him bail.
Were you able to discern a set of conditions that makes the emergence of these baseless conspiracies more likely?
Not particularly. Aside from, in the most general sense, social instability or social unrest, the reason that the daycare ritual abuse panic emerged in the 1980s had a lot to do with the really dramatically changing role of women in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Daycare was an important institution because that's where you send your kids if you're a mother who wants to get a full-time job. And there was a lot of anxiety, even mundane things like, will my child learn to read more slowly if he's at daycare and not being read to by his mother every day at home? And if you take that to its logical extreme, you know, what bad thing might happen to my child if I leave him at daycare? Well, the worst possible thing would be that an international conspiracy of Satanists would molest him.
That's quite the anxiety leap, but I see where you're going. Another occasion that you mentioned in your Slate article that resonated with Pizzagate was Omaha, Nebraska in 1989.
This outbreak of allegations centering around a little credit union, a prominent Republican fundraiser in charge of the credit union who was illegally misusing funds to sort of fund a lavish lifestyle for himself, and then an orphanage called Boys Town. And what started as just an investigation into the mishandling of funds at this credit union exploded into, and this sounds a little bit more like the Pizzagate allegations, you know, wild political parties where orphan boys from Boys Town are being flown into Washington, D.C. so that closeted politicians can have their way with them. Even George H.W. Bush himself was implicated because two quote-unquote male call boys were supposed to have been given a midnight tour of the White House.
A federal grand jury determined that the allegations were a hoax and indicted one of the alleged victims for perjury, but
conspiracy theory website still referred to this case from Omaha as, you know, a cover-up. They think it still really happened.
You wrote that moral panics function somewhat like parables. They validate a group's anxiety. They exonerate the anxious from culpability, and they assign blame. So how would you compare the object of the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, the Clintons and members of the Democratic elite, to the object of similar conspiracy theories in the past?
In the case of the daycare hysteria, the people accused of doing these horrible things, they're not prominent figures. They live in the same towns as the kids and parents. This is a panic about how the textures of domestic life are changing. Do mothers stay at home or go to work? This is a panic over the fact that what people felt like the normal rhythms of daily life were changing, and that maybe that was destructive.
What about 2016?
This panic is just about Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. And in fact, it's interesting. Obviously, on the surface, this sounds very, very different from the whole non-scandal over her emails. But it's actually very similar because both stories are stories about Hillary getting away with something. The Pizzagate conspiracy is just an exaggeration of a dynamic that already served as the foundation of Trump's campaign, which is that Hillary Clinton is a detached elitist and she only cares about fulfilling her own desires.
You know, what's kind of interesting is you mentioned earlier the anxiety in the 80s that maybe putting your kid in a daycare center could delay his reading skills. And the exaggeration of that panic into the worst possible thing, which is that they could be sexually molested. And here you've got the same thing. You start with her putting email on a server that could be vulnerable, and then that gets exaggerated into child sex abuse on a grand scale.
The only reason that Pizzagate is about child sex abuse is because Americans think that child sex abuse is the worst thing you can do. If America's boogeyman today were the arsonist, then Pizzagate would be about a bunch of unsolved house fires.
How do you deflate conspiracies, especially when there are real and widely reported examples of child abuse? You know, British TV presenter Jimmy Savile, Penn State's Jerry Sandusky, not to mention the Catholic Church. It seems that pointing out the implausibility doesn't really work.
I think that pointing out the implausibility on a case-by-case basis for journalists is about all that you can do. There was a comment or two on my Slate piece, although you're never supposed to read the comments, where someone was saying, God, just don't write about this. You know, you write about this and then the people who believe it just get angrier. So don't even bother trying to debunk it. Just ignore it and it will go away, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think just ignore it and it will go away is an effective strategy for dealing with this kind of thing. You have to look at the evidence. And if you look at the evidence against someone like Jerry Sandusky, it's incredibly strong. If you look at the evidence supporting the allegations made by the Pizzagaters,
It's non-existent.
Right.
Well, you do suggest that Pizzagate is just the latest manifestation of an anti-Washington sentiment. So do you think that we'll be seeing more of these?
I would not be surprised if a similar kind of hoax pops up over the course of the next few years. So long as this fever pitch of anti-Washington sentiment persists, and I certainly don't think that Donald Trump's administration is going to wind up doing anything to lessen that sentiment.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Richard Beck is author of We Believe the Children, A Moral Panic in the 1980s.
Also, who does pasta? Do you know what pasta you're doing? You can't do pasta. Or can you?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Paige Cowett. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, and Leia Fetter. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.